Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Zatarain's, a New Orleans tradition since 1889. From WWNO New Orleans and our studios in the Southern Food and Beverage Museum, this is Louisiana Eats. I'm Poppy Tooker. The Louisiana shellfish business is evolving quickly due to some changes in laws and regulations that have hampered innovation in the past. The Guerrero family of the Caminata Bay Premium Oyster Company are leading the way in new product with Louisiana's first farm-raised oysters. We're going out into the waters of Caminata Bay to learn all about this amazing new development. And marine biologist Rusty Godet joins us with big news about a new product that may be coming to a restaurant plate near you soon. Louisiana-grown clams. Then, we head into the kitchen to hear what Tori McPhail, the executive chef at Commander's Palace, is doing with this brand new Bounty of the Sea. It's creamy, it's sweet, it's salty. It's Louisiana shellfish time on this week's Louisiana Eats. At the end of LA-1, on the bottom edge of our state, is Grand Isle, Louisiana, a barrier island about 50 miles due south of New Orleans. While the island is well known as a tourist destination with its sandy beaches and fishing camps, it's also home to a number of individuals and families who make their living on the Gulf. One of these families is the Guerreros, who operate Caminata Bay Premium Oysters, a company that farms oysters, utilizing an off-bottom cage system, creating an entirely new Louisiana oyster who lives its entire life without ever touching the muddy bottom. On a clear blue morning, we met farmer Marcos Guerrero and his son Boris at the dock. In the adjacent shallow waters, two female marine biologists in yellow rubber overalls and boots were working triangular cages used in raising the baby oysters, known as spat. We climbed aboard their compact bay boat for a morning out on the water to learn the process of oyster farming in Caminata Bay.
Okay, we're going to the farm, Caminata Bay Premium Oyster Farm. It's right there by Caminata Pass, next to, in front of the island, close to the bridge, actually. It's a plot, it's like a park that the Port Commission with Wildlife and Fisheries and all the legislators from Louisiana make it happen, because it was no legislation before, so no one can have aquaculture in the state. This is the first time the law passed, I think, in 2012. So in 2013, we started doing the process, the paperwork, and then actually in 2013, would approve and start doing the infrastructure, did the anchors on the bottom of the sea, put the submarine lines and all the infrastructure that we need in order to grow these oysters.
So it took you approximately 2 years to get your business rolling.
That's true. It's about 2 years, and the good thing about these oysters is they can grow over there in a year. So it's 1 year preparation and then 1 year since we seed. We seed last year about this time, so now we're harvesting.
Tell me a little bit about the seeding process that you take part in.
Okay, we buy the seed from the hatchery and then we put it in a nursery. We buy it in a very tiny size. Then we make it grow in a nursery, like in a nursery on land. After they reach 4 millimeter, we start putting in the field, and from that time it takes about 10 months probably to be market size.
Only 10 months, and that's remarkable because your average oyster in the wild, in the normal way that oysters grow, how long do they usually take before they are ready for harvest?
They said about 2 to 3 years to be ready. And the beauty of this one is that the place where we are gave this unique flavor to these kind of oysters. The bay is so rich in flavors. While once you feel the oyster, you can taste like the wild flower oyster herbs inside. The sea salty. The texture is great. What happens over there at the bay?
It is a unique and incredible oyster, different than any I've ever tasted in Louisiana. They're also so beautiful. Can you explain to me why the oysters that you are growing have deep cups and flat tops, different from a typical Louisiana oyster?
Yes, those oysters are, the lab select the best of the male and females, and then we have a special type of oysters. Those oysters don't spawn. That's another good thing. So that means during the summertime, when usually wild oysters are spawning, our oyster doesn't spawn. And being on the first 12 inches of the surface, that's where the most of the nutrients of the sea are. So they grow faster that way. They grow in cages. The cages protect them from predators, so we don't have to worry about that. They don't have to worry about predators. Now, in order to get this nice shape, like you said, we have to flip the cages once a week. So that's a lot of hard work and take a lot of time, because we have to wait until for a nice day, a day that is not raining or it's not too many waves. In order to flip the cages, they call this drying position. It's in a drying, so the oyster get dry. So it prevents to biofouling to form, and also incrustation on the shell. They prevent, so that's why you see the oyster coming later on so clean. And the shape too, its shape. Every time we tumble the oyster, it makes them form this cup at the bottom. So you can compare the same size, the wild oyster and our oysters, and it's gonna be holding more meat. So even if the same size, we have more meat, it's more weight also on the oyster.
Huge flocks of pelicans and seagulls flew overhead, and the sun reflected brilliantly on the water as we made our way further and further away from the shore. Marcos, while we're on our way to the site of your farm, tell me a bit about your family's history, because I understand that you all are from Ecuador, I believe, and you've always been involved in various food businesses of one type or another.
That's correct. Originally from Ecuador, on my mother's side, we're also Italian, so we have kind of a mix of the both continents. And my son Boris here, my wife, and the other son Aldo, we all working together here at the farm. We had a little bit of experience with some shrimping industry before, some farming also, organic farming. We always were farming on the organic way. We don't like to contaminate our water. And that's another beauty of the oyster. They filter water. They filter up to 50 gallons each animal per day. So that's a huge machine filtering bay waters, giving more life also to the water, to the bay.
I understand that at one point you all were involved in a sugar business of some sort. And I'd never heard of this kind of sugar business. Would you tell me about that?
Yes, we were doing organic sugarcane. So in the end, we were grinding our own sugarcane and having a, like we call it panela, but it's like a organic sugar, but without any chemical, not at all, even in, not on the field, not in the process.
There's not very many organic sugarcane operations that I am aware of. Is that fairly prevalent in Ecuador, and how did you all become so concerned with the organic side of it?
Yeah, that's true. It's not, and we always were concerned about, because we believe that this world is not ours; it's for our next generations, and we have to keep it clean and safe for them. Other than that, the human species is going to disappear. And the other thing is that we were looking at the beginning here to do some of organic farming, but there is no land available here. If there is a piece of land, it's already contaminated or it's next to a big rice industry or sugarcane industry or pasture that they use a lot of chemicals. So you won't be able to do it. So that's why we moved to the sea, because I think it's not too contaminated yet.
The waters down here in particular in Caminata Bay, the waters are very beautiful. It's such an amazing fishery down here.
Yes, that's true. And another beauty of being in the park is that it's permitted water by DHH. That means they come regularly and check the quality of the water. So our oysters really are certified, we could say, each one by DHH.
Amazing, amazing. When we come back from a short break, our watery farming adventure continues as we take a first-hand look at off-bottom oyster farming in Caminata Bay. Stay tuned. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen and Zatarain's.
The morning turned my way, seabirds flying through.
Our journey from Grand Isle into the heart of Caminata Bay continues with Caminata Bay premium oyster farmer Marcus Guerrero and his son Boris. As the boat slowed down and we began our approach to their underwater farm, I noticed several black devices about 2 feet in diameter floating on the clear water. Alongside of them were rows of white polyethylene plastic pipes jutting 7 or 8 feet out above the water. Another thing that amazed me that I didn't expect is that when you're going over traditional oyster beds in Louisiana, they're always marked by those white poles. The white poles are... So you have poles out here too. And is that to show people that this is an oyster bed so that they don't accidentally run their boats around in it?
That's a good question. Boris can explain to you what happens here with the poles.
Well, the poles are made for keep people out, but it really doesn't stop them. People still come in here and fish and everything, and sometimes we get a little issue because the hooks get stuck in the line and we grab it, and sometimes we you know cut our hands because we grab where the hook is. So a lot of people do keep out though, and we tell them to fish around the poles. Uh-huh. But it's still kind of, they like to be right there in the, you know, next to the cages fishing. Because, I mean, it kind of, the cages also create like a reef. Yeah. So a lot of fishes are around because there's like crabs and everything. So they, you know, there's a lot of food around it.
A good thing maybe to tell is that people is not aware what is aquaculture marks. If you see the yellow poles on the end, at the very end of the park, that yes. means aquaculture. So maybe it's a good thing to tell all fishermen, when you see yellow poles, that means aquaculture, just be careful. We have some signs saying they're underwater obstructions, but it seems to be that nobody read those signs.
Well, you know, this is another first. Having fished my whole life and spent a great deal of it on the water, the poles themselves aren't yellow. I want to make sure that everybody understands what we're talking about is like a yellow caution tape at the top of the normal polyethylene white poles.
I think there's only two or like four maybe of the yellow. You see the tall one?
Yes.
The next one, I think those are yellows. And then on the other corner there, it should have a yellow post. So they're not like fully marked all the plots, but they have the corners. That poor commission mark, they are marked with a yellow post.
Now, what are the black things that we see floating in the water? Can you explain to me what those are?
We can go pick one up.
Okay. Boris slowly navigated between the white poles, taking us over to one of the black torpedo-shaped floating devices.
Which one are you going to take? Second.
Stopping the boat, Boris and his father each grabbed one end of the device, pulling a heavy wire cage onto our boat, packed with growing baby oysters.
So this is the cage, the floating devices. It's a fish. Okay, you see what we're talking about?
Yes, exactly.
The loop protection here, this is a reef for them. So what we do is, before the beginning, we were doing the same as you saw, but later on we put the pulley and we kind of the hydraulic system that help us move the cage here on top and then release it on the other side. So it comes this way, we take the bags, take whatever we need to do, the seed.
So you can see we put the seed this.
There's the little babies.
Yeah, these are from, they spawned in July. So yeah, there are little babies there for next season.
The hatchery produced is a mix, if you put it that way, between a diploid oyster and tetraploid. Once they mix the two, it comes a triploid. It's the same as the other oyster. The only thing is they don't spawn. It's like a seedless watermelon, the same nice watermelon but without the seed. That's the only difference. And that allowed us to sell it whole year round, especially in summertime. Do we call it the summer crop? Because we can harvest during the summer without any problem.
And not only that, they spend all their energy growing instead of also, you know, spawning.
Yeah, instead of spawning,
So the meat, it stays meatier for that case, because all they do is grow and eat. So yeah, this will be for next season. The other ones are kind of heavy. We'll have to use the whole thing to bake them up.
Cool.
Yeah, that's what we see them float them deeper than these are.
Yeah, so that's the difference also. Mm. So the ones that are deeper is where
ready to harvest. They're ready to harvest.
Oh, so that's how you even can tell without some sort of great memory or complicated map,
right,
huh?
Exactly.
We do, but sometimes here we have to just come over what we see. Okay, we remember.
Yeah.
We're every day here almost.
We start usually from this side to that side, so harvesting, yeah.
So we had an order.
What has the reaction been from the chefs in the city to your oysters? Tell me about how your business is going as far as from farm to table.
It's very positive. I mean, the chefs have been loving this oyster, especially because also we give them to them clean. So not only the flavor, just started with the cleanliness. They don't have to like have another sink to clean them or put somebody else. But the flavor, I mean, they love it. Every time somebody tastes it, we just get tons of positive feedback of how good it tastes. And, you know, they basically tell us it's almost like tasting the sea, you know?
What dawned on me the first time I tasted one and understood what you all were doing out here is that this is the first time we've ever had a Louisiana oyster that didn't grow in the mud.
That's correct. That's correct. So they love it. I mean,
the currents. You see the currents?
That's another thing. We have plenty of wind, plenty of currents, and most of the waves are on top. So every time it passes one, it keeps them kind of clean. You know, not fully clean, but it helps. Every little helps.
The tidal action out here in Caminata Bay is another part of the assistance in your farming.
Of course, and also the wind. The tidal, all the water coming from those marshlands keep the flavor, the nice flavor of the oyster and the nutrients, yes.
So name drop for me a little bit. So who's using your oysters?
So we have a couple of them. One's Commander's Palace. Another one is Bourne Restaurant by the Hyatt. The Curious Oyster in the St. Rock Market. And Marissa.
Well, I'm sure that there's a much bigger market. It's just a matter of making more oysters, right, gentlemen?
That's right.
So have you had a theft problem out here?
So we had, earlier this year, we had two cages stolen from us, from the line. I mean, I think they probably tried to take the whole line, because when we find the line, everything, like the cages, now you see them organized, they were all like on one side. Like they were just picked up the line or something. But two of the cages with 1,400 oysters were stolen from us earlier this year.
1,400 oysters. So each cage grows about 700? Is that, what's the yield out of each cage?
Yeah, we have it right now. We're trying the amount that we can put in it, but we know that, for example, in other parts of Canada, they grow up to 1,000 each cage. So we are kind of pushing a little bit, seeing, understanding also how it reacts, what happens here. So we put just 700. We have some of 800. We have some of 900 too. We never put 1,000, but we are trying of trying and see what's the best amount that it can hold.
Well, you all are brave pioneers. That's the truth.
Thank you very much. Yes, we're here every day thinking, and so many nights without sleeping, just thinking on what we have here. It's not too easy. But we got a great product. We got a great response. That makes us move forward, really. People like you coming here and having this talk here, that's fantastic.
Marcos and Boris Guerrero of Caminata Bay Premium Oysters. After experiencing oyster farming firsthand, I wanted to learn the science behind these amazing mollusks. So we ventured over to the Grand Isle Oyster Hatchery, a research facility that's been operating since 1993. Here, we were introduced to Lisa.
Hello, my name is Lisa Barassa. I'm a research associate with Louisiana Sea Grant, part of LSU College Program. And I work at the Louisiana Sea Grant and LWF Oyster Hatchery, where I work as one of the phycologists. So my main job is I grow algae to feed oysters that we hold in the hatchery.
To successfully grow oysters in a lab, cultivating algae is an essential component to the process. Lisa walked us through her role in this delicate oyster spawning operation.
So all of it is in a hatchery that we have here in Grand Isle. And this actually starts in this little room over here, which is the algal stock room, which I can show you in. For people listening, it's sort of a mix between a mad scientist lair with bubbling flask of algae and these crazy lights, sort of like club algae mad scientist lair. It's pretty cool. Sure.
Lisa took us into a room filled with several rows of bubbling liquid flasks against a wall.
Wow.
Each illuminated with different spectra of light.
Wow. Okay, this is crazy in here.
Tell us, Lisa, what are we looking at here?
So we are looking at flasks of different types of algae grown under red, white, and blue LED lights. And we chose these specific colors because colors are representative of the wavelength of the light. And so we targeted the colors that are best for the growth and lipid production of algae. And so ultimately, our goal is to grow high-quality algae or the food for the oysters. So we, at the end, we get a really good high-quality oyster. And so we have 4 different species that we grow here, just to basically cover all aspects of an oyster growth and development so it gets the best type of food. Like, you can eat the most kale that you want, and it's really, really healthy for you. But if you only eat kale, you're not going to be that healthy. So here, we have the best diet that we can possibly give to the oyster so we get a really good high-quality oyster in the end.
So red, white, and blue are the best colors for this?
Technically, red and blue are, yes. We sort of threw white in there because white is the entire spectrum of the sun, so we're not missing anything we're not losing anything.
What's happening in those flasks over there?
So this all starts in, we first get our starter cultures of algae in 15 milliliter tubes, just really small volume, and then we add it to the right amount of seawater and nutrients to grow. So we have to start in small volumes and gradually add up. And you can see these ones aren't bubbling, and this is because we want to be able to control the growth and make sure there's no introduction of contaminants that might be introduced by the air that we bubble in. But to make it grow faster, we aerate them, which is the bubbling that you see. And basically, it just starts off in these 500 milliliter Erlenmeyer flasks that you would see in any chemistry classroom, and just it transitions up to larger volumes. And then ultimately, this is what provides the algae for our algal production system, which generates 450 gallons of really, really dark, really, really concentrated algae. So we can try and produce, our goal is to produce 1 billion larvae a year in this facility. So we need to have really high density and really high concentration and volume of algae to be able to do that. But it all starts here.
So from start to finish, how long does this algae project take?
It takes about 2.5 weeks to get into the bag system. And then from there, it takes about 5 to 7 days to be able to generate enough algae that keeps going. So I guess in total about 3 weeks to be able to have a self-sustaining continuous system.
Next, Lisa took us into the larval production room, filled with massive white containers.
So yeah, we have these, there are three 4,500 liter tanks we call our hatching tanks. So basically we collect all the eggs and the sperm, fertilize the eggs so we get the larvae, and then put them in there for a couple days, wait for them to develop into like about 60 micron oyster larva, and then they're put into these cylindrical tanks over here, which are continuous. So they're always getting fresh water, they're always getting algae, and in here we can grow 40 million larvae in a tank.
40 million larvae in a tank?
Yeah, 40 million larvae in a tank. So our goal is to be able to produce, I think, 100 million larvae every 2 weeks. Because it's about a 2-week process from egg to setting. And then from there, we take the larvae that have set onto a colt's material, put them in our nursery, wait for them to grow up a bit, and then we can give the seed oysters to Marcos or to researchers or any other oysterman, anyone interested in the larvae.
Heading back into the main room with Lisa, she gave us a step-by-step lesson in how the oysters are raised in the facility.
So as part of the hatchery, we maintain our broodstock and an oyster demonstration farm right here in Grand Isle. And there we basically hold our parent oysters and then bring them into the lab, induce them to spawn, and we catch the gametes, so the eggs and the sperm. We combine them to get fertilized eggs. Then from there we get trochophore larvae, just basically swimming, the oyster larvae swim around for a bit first. And then eventually they actually grow a foot. And they crawl onto substrate, onto something, until they find a good suitable place where they want to sit down and live for the rest of their life. And then from there, once they develop their foot, find a suitable substrate, set onto it, they grow into spat, which then, after a bit, becomes seed oysters. Mm-hmm. And then back, it repeats the process, then from seed oysters, they grow into adults. But so the overall process here in the hatchery is, so we start with the algae, which is, like I said, the food for the oysters. We induce the oysters to spawn, combine them all. So we feed the oyster larvae, grow them up in the hatching tanks for up to 4 days, which then they go into that continuous system that I was talking about, where we can grow 40 million larvae in a tank. And then we harvest them at about 12 days, 12 to 21 days. And then from there, we can set them onto whatever colt's material we like. So in the wild, an oyster would set onto another oyster shell. Here in the lab, we can sort of choose what type of colt's material we want to use, either another oyster shell or little pieces of sand, or a lot of researchers at LSU are looking at alternatives that we can use. Yeah, to shell.
And what would a shell alternative be?
I think they're looking at different types of limestone. One was chicken scratch, just something else that we can use as artificially to have something for the oysters set onto to hopefully rebuild and rehabilitate the oyster reefs out in the wild. A big part of what we do here is we work with Louisiana Department of Wildlife and Fisheries and grow, most of those larvae that we grow are used for reef rehabilitation. So for that, the department takes aged oyster shells that have basically been taken from a shucking house, aged in the sun a bit, and they're put into mesh bags. From there, the mesh bags are put into a tank, and we add oyster larvae that have grown, that have that foot on them, and they're just crawling around, and they set onto those oyster shells. Then the state takes those oyster shells and puts them out onto the public leases and try and rehabilitate those for the oystermen and reef restoration here.
Now, what do you have in these jars? They're shells, they're in water. What are these here for?
So these are actually from a plot that LDWF put out there where they had a bunch of oyster shells that we took from the tanks that they put out on the reef, and they basically went back and recollected some of those shells just to sort of survey and analyze what's going on, see if there's how much mortality there is, what's survival. So in this jar here, you can see all these little oysters set onto the oyster shell. So that's after 1 month, they're about the size of your pinky nail or so. At month two, they went back to the same exact spots in Hackberry Bay and collected from the same plots. And you can see that in month two, they're about the size of your thumbnail now. So these are whole oyster shells with oysters that we grew in the hatchery and set onto them. And then LDWF takes the oyster shells out, puts them on the reef, and tries to rehabilitate it. But we got to survey it to make sure that it's actually working and everything. So these are samples of that.
Lisa, I am so glad to have caught you here in your mad scientist laboratory on Grand Isle. Thanks for talking with us on Louisiana Eats.
You're welcome. I'm very happy to do it. I'm glad you came down.
Do I feed the oysters?
makes an oyster salty? We'll share that pearl of wisdom when we come right back. Stay tuned. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is made possible with major support from Rouse's Markets. Here's this week's culinary quiz question, brought to you with support from Popeye's Louisiana Culinary Institute. What makes an oyster salty? Oysters taste of the waters where they grow and are harvested from. So the brackish inland waters of Louisiana's bays can produce oysters with less of a salty taste. The closer to the Gulf of Mexico waters that an oyster grows in, the saltier it will be. Each sack of oysters is tagged with the zone number assigned by the state of Louisiana, revealing exactly where they were harvested. I know oystermen who are so concerned with having the saltiest oysters that they actually allow the oysters to develop in one bay and then move them to beds where the water has more salinity to finish them off before harvesting them for market. Ask any Louisiana chef, and you'll find they're quite particular about which zone their oysters come from. I'm Poppy Tooker. And salty Gulf oysters are real Louisiana eats. Eye of the pearl, the 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 eye of the pearl. Marine biologist Rusty Godet of LSU's Sea Grant program has harbored a secret passion for many years. Louisiana's waters have a great abundance of clams. That's right. Louisiana clams, exactly like the East Coast clams you've probably enjoyed in dishes like clam chowder and clams casino. Rusty knew that there was some obscure language in the laws regarding oyster fishing that prevented oystermen from keeping the clams that sometimes are raked in along with the oysters. For many years, he's been working to find a way for oystermen to harvest and sell those clams, and now he's here with some big, exciting news about the Louisiana clam.
In Louisiana, we basically have two predominant clams that people are familiar with. Most people are more familiar with the rangier clams or the Lake Pontchartrain clam, which is a smaller clam. It's more of a estuarine brackish water clam. The other clam is the Louisiana quahog, which is a more of a saline water, a deeper water clam, which lives a little bit further out from the shoreline. They've been here since the beginning of time. The first survey on southern quahogs in Louisiana was done in 1908. Since that time, very little of the southern quahog have made it into commercial use in Louisiana, or for that matter, anywhere. That being said, in the late 70s, there was an effort with Louisiana Wildlife and Fishery and the Pacina family to harvest some of the southern quahogs for meat. And they went very well. The problem is that the meat was not cost competitive with the meat stocks that they were coming out of the Northeast. Most of the meats, the clam meats that are used with that, are from ocean quahogs, which are ocean clams that are harvested by big, huge boats in deep waters, and they harvested by the tons. So that effort back in the 70s was pretty much abandoned, and from that time on, the harvest of Louisiana quahogs, Louisiana clams, has been restricted to a recreational take. They cannot go into trade.
Well, for years, you have been talking to me about this Louisiana quahog and how one day it was going to be available if it was the last thing you did. Why have you been on such a mission about this clam?
Well, as a Sea Grant fishery agent, my mission in a statement is the appropriate use of coastal resources. And that includes to draw attention to something that is underexploited or to draw attention to something that is overexploited. In the case of the Louisiana quahog, it is a very big resource that we have available very close off the shoreline of Louisiana that is not being utilized to its fullest. The stocks of Mercenaria on the East Coast have been dwindling, so that makes that the stocks, the Mercenaria stocks along the Gulf Coast, the last unexploited reservoir of clams that we have in the United States for as far as nearshore species.
So when you set out to make this available and to change the way things were, you sort of discovered almost a loophole in the wording of the law.
Well, it's not so much a loophole as it is a ambiguity that was ill-defined because there really was no demand for the clam in the commercial sector. So by making it crystal clear to both the oystermen and to enforcement and to the regulatory community and to the health community that this is, in fact, a legitimate bycatch of the oyster industry, we have now crystallized the fact that the clams can be brought into commercial trade as a incidental bycatch of the normal oyster industry.
Well, that's pretty exciting. Let's talk about the clams themselves, because I have to admit, the first time you showed me one of these clams, I was simply wowed because they're huge. They grow to an enormous size. So the stocks of these quahogs that are out in the coastal waters of Louisiana are old and gigantic, aren't they?
Well, they can be. They can be 35, 40 years old, in which case that they're nearly the wet weight, in other words, the live weight, is nearly a kilo, 2.2 pounds. But they have a tremendous advantage over the oyster is because the clam has a big foot, a big muscular foot, and that allows it to migrate vertically in the sand matrix that it lives in. When a hurricane comes and it deposits a layer of sediment on the oysters, it will smother that oyster reef. But the clam can migrate vertically, and it can go up to the surface.
How do they taste? How does the taste compare to the East Coast clam?
The flavor of the Louisiana quahog, the southern quahog, is really dependent upon the size of the individual clam that you happen to be consuming. The smaller ones are less strong. The bigger ones, like the ones I showed you, the almost 1 kilo.
Yeah, they're like fist size.
Yeah, fist size or better. Are a bit strong, but they're great in chowders and clam casino and stuff like that. They have a lot of what we call juice, you know. So there's a very large percentage of the weight of the animal that comes out in this juice, which is really the blood of the animal, and then that in turn flavors these prepared concoctions like clams casino, clams. Or stuffies. On a raw bar, the smaller ones are excellent, very nice, briny taste, not with a heavy metallic finish, but it's a top-notch animal, depending upon the size that you get, of course.
So have any of these clams made it into commerce yet?
My guess right now, my best guess estimate, is that we have about 1,000 pounds of hard clams coming into just the New Orleans area every week. So that's 2 tons a month. That's 24 tons a year that are coming in to just the New Orleans area through various fish houses. So there's a big demand for hard clams, which is they're using either the East Coast or the western shoreline of Florida clams.
Ah.
But we have that same clam here. That's the same thing as us calling Sacramento, California, and ordering crawfish from Sacramento.
Well, this is an incredibly exciting future for this clam and for the oysterman or anyone else who's willing to get into this business. I cannot thank you enough for coming to see us on Louisiana Eats and giving us the scoop on this incredible opportunity for Louisiana and for all the chefs and for all the seafood purveyors, because there's a new clam in town and it's pretty delicious.
And it's our clam.
And it's our clam.
All right.
Thank you, Rusty.
You're welcome.
Thanks so much for the scoop. Marine biologist Rusty Godet of LSU's Sea Grant Program. While we're waiting for Rusty's Louisiana clams to make it into the marketplace, I'll share with you my favorite clam recipe, one that I always know is in my pantry ready to roll out for a quick supper and a moment's notice. Clams and spaghetti. It doesn't come easier and quicker than this one. Use 1 6.5-ounce can of minced clams for every 2 people that you're serving. Add some olive oil into a sauté pan and pour in the entire contents of the can of clams, juice and all. Add some chopped garlic along with some salt and freshly ground black pepper. Bring the whole mixture to a boil and let it reduce by half. Take the pan off the heat and toss in some freshly chopped Italian parsley. To enrich the sauce, whisk a tablespoon of butter into the clam mixture. Pour the sauce over the cooked pasta and toss in some grated Italian cheese. Trust me, this dish is simply irresistible, and it's sure to be a go-to family favorite when dinner has to be ready in a rush. For a copy of this recipe, visit our Louisiana Eats website at itsneworleans.com and wwno.org. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats. We learned from the Guerrero family that Commander's Palace was one of the first customers to use their unique new product. So we headed over to the kitchen there to hear Chef Tori McPhail's thoughts on Caminata Bay premium oysters.
My name's Tori McPhail, and I'm the executive chef at Commander's Palace here in Uptown New Orleans. We have really close ties to the Crescent City Farmers Market, and I ended up getting an email from Emery. And she says, hey, look, the guys, Marcos and the guys from Caminata Bay are coming up with their oysters. We have some oysters set aside for you, and we'd like you and a couple of the other main chefs in New Orleans to swing over to the farmer's market, do your regular shopping and all that stuff on a Saturday morning, but then check out some of these really cool oysters. And so I swung over, said hello, met Marcos for the very first time, and some of the other family, and I kind of got the backstory and really what's happening with these amazing Louisiana farm-raised oysters. And so we brought the oysters back and unloaded my Jeep with all the fresh produce, and that time was like peach season, right? So we had all this fresh stuff right from the market, and I started popping these oysters. And it was on the sideline here on a Saturday, like mid-morning, and I start handing out these oysters to all my sous chefs, right? And the brunch tickets are coming in, and these oysters are just absolutely fantastic. And so one after the next, they're salty, they're briny, they're amazing, and that's how it all got started.
What is the difference, in your experience, between the Caminata Bay oysters and the oysters you've always had available to you?
Well, I'm a huge Louisiana oyster fan, and I eat oysters all the time in my off days. But these oysters, I find they're superior for a lot of reasons. And I think the number one thing is the salinity, right? They're so big and bold, and they have such an amazing oyster flavor. And they don't sometimes taste washed out. Like, if you get a lot of rain in some of the Louisiana oysters, it tastes like a little bit more mild. These, the cups are deeper. Okay, so I don't know if that rinses out some of the salinity on a typical oyster, but these really capture that great briny flavor that we've come to love out of a great Louisiana oyster. For me, I grew up in Washington State, right? And that Puget Sound flavor, you have flavors of like, in a Kumamoto oyster, flavors like cucumber and lemon, and sometimes it's like a copper penny kind of a flavor to them. And these just have all the great qualities you'd expect out of oyster, but you don't have to deal with all the grit and silt that you'd find in a bottom oyster.
And what have you done with them here? When you get them, what do you use them in?
Well, I think that's part of the thing for like us Louisiana chefs. It's not necessarily about the feel of a restaurant. As an example, like if you think about Commander's, I never feel like Commander's is a half-shell oyster restaurant, right? And you can go to countless places around the city and get an ice-cold draft beer and a dozen raw oysters and just be, happy as a clam, so to speak, right? And so the deal for us is, it's not necessarily about the feel of the restaurant. When a chef comes across a product that is superior for any reason, you need to get that on the menu, okay? And that's what Louisiana chefs have been doing around the state for hundreds and hundreds of years. And so what we do is we do the hard work ahead of time, right? We staff our kitchen with the best people we possibly can, and when the orders come into the kitchen, we're popping fresh oysters, and typically it's either me or a sous chef, right, on the sideline doing our thing, popping them, and then for us, it's very simple. We add a little bit of a lemon mignonette, but we also take fresh sugarcane vinegar, okay? We take that, we add just a little bit of sugarcane juice to it. We put it in the sorbet machine, and it spits out sugarcane vinegar sorbet. So we freeze that, and then we ball it up so it looks like a tiny little pearl, okay? So we shuck our oyster, add a little lemon mignonette, add a sugarcane vinegar pearl to the top of each oyster, and as it goes to the table, that sugarcane vinegar pearl starts to melt across the top of it, and that becomes the sauce for each and every oyster.
That sounds so delicious. I can't get over it. And what has the customer's reaction been to this?
It's been absolutely overwhelming. And I'm just shocked. I was kind of figuring, well, shoot, you know, I love the oysters. All the sous chefs love the oysters. We eat them all the time. Don't tell the Brennans. But we're constantly eating really good oysters. And every time I get a batch, I'm like, man, these are just so much more unique. Nothing to knock a typical Louisiana oyster, but this is an unusual, very unique product. And I feel like top-tier restaurants across the city would be snapping these up. They've been so popular that... right now I'm out, and so Marcos and the guys are bringing me another 800 today, right? So we go through 800 like every other day, right? Which is kind of crazy, you know? And here we are, you know, people come to us for like the best truffles and the best foie gras and the best fine fish and imported European whatever, and here they are, you know, Commander's is, you know, we've always been a seafood house, okay? But now we're doing half-shell oysters for the very first time.
Another thing that really struck me when I thought about you here working with these oysters, it seems to be in keeping with the profile of the standard originally set at Commander's by Paul Prudhoe. Chef Paul was the one who really turned Commander's into a restaurant that was focused on local, seasonal, regional foods and flavors. And the fact that you all are the first responders, so to speak, on these Caminata Bay oysters just is the perfect fit that his legacy is continuing here.
I would absolutely agree with you. And that's what Ella's really been all about. It's what the Brennan family have really all been about. And thanks to Paul back in the 70s, I feel like Commander's, even decades and decades later, if somebody wants to come in and have a good sampling of what Louisiana is, what it always has been, you come to Commander's. You know you're going to get fantastic service, right? It's a beautiful old historic building in the heart of the Garden District, but you know you're going to have some of the most fantastic food as well. And these Caminata Bay oysters help tell the Louisiana story. And without that, I don't think Commander's would be as good. So just one more notch in the belt of great, great food.
Well, you are a serious putting the notch in the belt of the great, great food person. And I'm so honored that you made the time to duck out of the kitchen and have a quick talk with us about this remarkable new Louisiana product.
Well, thank you so much, Poppy. I really appreciate it. And then swing back anytime. You know, we're fantastic friends. Anything we can ever do for you here at Commander's, I'm proud to do that.
Thank you, Tori.
You got it.
Executive Chef Tori McPhail of New Orleans Commander's Palace.
Such a prince since Lord knows when.
When I've got those optimism blues.
That's it for this week's edition of Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Join us next week when we'll learn what to do when Thanksgiving family dinner means you and your best feline friend, the cat.
I cook a lot, and Lucy is inspecting all the produce that I'm about to chop. She is inspecting any can that I might be opening, and she is incredibly heavily involved in anything I do, and that certainly includes the kitchen, which is her favorite place to be.
Subscribe to our podcast, hear today's show, or catch up on previous editions anytime online at itsneworleans.com. Louisiana Eats is made possible with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen, Rouse's Markets, and Zatarain's. Additional support for Louisiana Eats is provided by the Shreveport-Bossier Convention and Tourist Bureau and by Dickie Brennan's Steakhouse, a local New Orleans steakhouse serving prime beef in New Orleans' French Quarter. Original theme music by Johnny Sketch and the Dirty Notes. Big thanks to producers Joe Schreiner, Sarah Holtz, and Sean Johnson. Come visit us anytime in our Louisiana Eats studios at the Southern Food and Beverage Museum. I'm Poppy Tooker. Louisiana Eats is a production of WWNO and the University of New Orleans.